Welcome back to Evolution of Snake. I'm Zach.
And I am Madeline.
And we're here today in Spotify Studios. Hello! Greatest, biggest, hugest podcast in the world. They shut down the whole building
Welcome
for us.
Welcome to New York. It's been waiting for you. Welcome to New York. Welcome to New York.
We have been welcomed to New York. And you'll hear more about our experience in New York and where we're living in our Kiki Lounge, which is only available at patreon.com/astrologist. But we have something more important than that to promote for you. By the time you're watching this, we are just about to come to Canada. We're going to Montreal and Toronto this weekend. Evolutionsnake.com. Go get your tickets. Next week, we're going to be in Washington, D.C. Are we going anywhere else that week? Or do we? I think we just have the one show next
Chicago.
Week. Chicago. Oh, no. Next week. D.C.
Boston.
Boston and Philly the following week. And then we're in L.A., San Francisco, and Vancouver. Get your ass up. Evolutionsnake.com. Get tickets. We are ready to fucking rock, honestly. Life of a showgirl is something that needs to be.
We're in New York and we're ready to rock. That's all you have to know.
And you know what? Taylor always comes through with a gift when we go on tour. Have you noticed that? Last time she said, I got my master's back. That gave us something. Let's give him something to talk about.
She did. That was amazing.
She's given us two things to talk about, actually. I think we should start off with the nonsense. The Toy Story countdown.
The thing is that's real, but I just don't understand why she took it away. Like, it must have been a big mistake.
It's like that Beyonce video of the lights going wrong at her concert, and she's going, somebody's getting fired. Somebody's getting fired. Someone's getting fired.
And the thing is, it wasn't hard to parse what it was.
Especially when she did the outfit the day before. There's always a reason for hideousina.
You have to put blue, yellow, and red into one outfit. And she managed to do it in an interesting way. I actually liked the bag and the dress, but if it was the red lip,
the
you
shoe.
See? But she had to Toy Story. You see, when you have to get your ass up in Toy Story.
I'm curious to hear what she's going to cook up.
Oh, I'm ready. No, I want it. I heard that. I said, you know what? Toy Story is about, like, I mean, if I may. Toy Story is about, like, friendship and, like, close relationships. So it's like, some people might think, ooh, Secret Life of Pets. Oh, no.
No, this is going to be something profound and meaningful.
This is going to be something profound. This is going to be, like, in It's Nice to Have a Friend moment.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that's coming to my mind, this wasn't in Toy Story, but you've got a friend in me. That's what it was.
Yeah.
But I was going to say the Tarzan song.
Which
You'll
one is that?
Be in my
And
heart.
Taylor could eat down with that.
Oh, she could eat a Phil Collins moment. In a heartbeat.
I want to hear her do a song from Jesse's perspective. That's really what I need to hear.
And that's what everybody's assuming.
But you could be wrong.
But you could be wrong. Mason is under the impression that, I don't think he's right because I don't think she would do a countdown for this, but Mason's tin hat theory is that she's voicing a character.
Oh.
And like they're going to like make a new character and she's going to voice it. I wouldn't hate it.
I would prefer it if it was a song. If it's both, oh, mamas, I'm eating good. If I have to watch Taylor act, that's my preferred venue for her to be doing acting.
There was somebody who was saying that she's doing the whole soundtrack, which I would eat.
Well, she just did her songwriting interview.
So
she's like, hey, guys, remember, I'm actually kind of good at writing songs.
She also specifically said something in the songwriting interview about characters, writing about characters. And it's like, well, there's a character I know. Her name is Jessie. She's a cowgirl. She wears a red hat.
It's not Jessie Murph, just letting everybody know.
She's got a horse. I believe the horse's name is Domino or Roundup.
I haven't watched it in a long time.
I can't remember the horse's name.
I didn't even know there was a Toy Story 4, if I'm speaking my truth.
If I'm speaking my truth, we really don't need a Toy Story 5. But it's happening, and Taylor's a part of it. So I will be there. So that's all we need to know.
But that Taylor Nation employee... Oh, this shit doesn't happen. They don't fuck up like that. The last time I remember them doing a really obvious flop was in Singapore when they accidentally started live streaming randomly and she wasn't announcing anything. She just played Dress and I Don't Want to Live Forever and it like cut off halfway through. Someone clearly had just hit live at the wrong point. It was supposed to be for the following night when she announced a different variation. So they just screwed it up.
As usual.
I thought this was a classy business.
No, they failed.
I thought this was a corporation. I thought it was Taylor Swift, Inc.
Well, I'm kind of annoyed because, like, okay, cat's out of the bag. Can you just announce it?
Yeah, tell us now.
Just tell us now because, like, because now people are starting to get ideas.
Now it looks egg on my face.
People are starting to really cook up some insane ideas, like Mason, for example. So we really need to nip that in the bud.
It encourages randomistas everywhere to get in their whodunit bag.
And they're... doing it was Colonel Mustard in the study with the with the candlestick.
That's kind of just the Swiftie experience now.
No,
I guess.
It is actually, it is, and like you can't even give them a crumb anymore.
You shouldn't.
They actually don't deserve
it. It's like the signs in the park that are like, please don't feed the pigeons. It makes them maniacal. So Taylor is one of the greatest songwriters in the world. I think some of us have been knowing that. I knew that. Did you know that?
Oh, I've been knowing it. And honestly, I know that there's haters and there's naysayers out there saying wrong, wrong, wrong. But at this point, I feel like if you're a naysayer, there's egg on your fucking face because everybody else is well aware of the fact. To me, it's like indisputable. There's a lot of things that you can say about Taylor. Some of the critiques I'll let you say and I'll mind my own fucking business and I won't even argue and I won't mount my steed. But you can't come after the fact that she's one of the greatest living songwriters. That's just not period.
No, the two unassailable things that I will like go to the mat for Taylor for are the power of her pen and her right to own her master recordings. Those are two things where my hen heart is high up in the air and you will never ever be able to shoot it down. No matter what happens to me, that hen heart, it's 20,000 feet in the sky with the bridge that Taylor's riding.
Exactly. It is as iconic, it is as memorable, it is as beautiful, it is as stately as the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. And it's never coming down.
You think the Golden Gate Bridge is going to fall down?
No.
It's not.
No. Because they tend to it, because they love it, because it's a beautiful structure. And that's how I feel about Taylor's songwriting.
I feel like it's a universally critically agreed opinion that Taylor Swift is a really good songwriter. People have quibbles about specific albums or specific quirks that she has, but I think that if you are, and you know, there's always going to be pick me to be different, but I think that when you insist that Taylor is not as good as everyone says she is, you just look stupid because it's such an undeniably proven fact, and it is a generally, not even from a delusional Swiftie perspective, it's just like a general consensus that she is, at the very minimum, good.
Well, it's pick me behavior. If you're saying, she didn't deserve to be there, pick me. You doing pick me.
Pick me.
Pick me.
Was she the youngest person that was on the list?
I think Bad Bunny was on it, and I feel like he's younger.
He is younger than her. But she's there. And guess who introduced her to this event? Her person that was her little cheerleader describing why she was the greatest songwriter in the world was Stevie Nicks. And this is what Stevie had to say. She kind of kills me. This is written like a poem, by the way. You ask about her brilliance. I can only say, if only I had written it. For me, this song will always live in my heart. You're on your own, kid. You always have been. Then, I feel that her song is generational. She's talking about, literally, she's going on a Coke rant about you're on your own, kid. Me! Me! I think it's all her relationships written into one song. A little bit of this, a little bit of that, and dropped into my lap. Over time, I have dropped in my own great loves to stand in her story, and it makes me cry for both of us, what we lost, what we learned, and how we survived. That is how a great songwriter reaches into people's hearts and connects with them. All that beauty and tragedy and life's lessons have led her down the path of unstoppable creativity. She just doesn't stop, and that is what has turned her into this beautiful young woman who makes magic with everything she touches. P.S. Yes, this is the song that reconnected Taylor and I. The title of the song is something Christine would have said to me after she passed away, and I felt it came through Taylor. It helped me a lot to let her go and brought me a new friend. Are you picking up what I picked up on that?
Yeah, I picked up. After the Grammys, Stevie said, get the fuck away from me and don't ever come near me again.
She said, I'm not interested in this.
No.
Whatever that is, keep it away from me.
Get me away from this. And you know what? We have to say fair. Tyler, roll the tape.
Roll the Taylor tape. We have an episode coming out soon that actually delves all the way into that specific moment. But when I found out that Stevie said reconnected, I started chortling. I thought it was so funny because there has been so much time between 2010 and Midnight's, 12 years.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
But the thing is, you're on your own, kid. You always have been.
The ancient Aztecs were saying that. I think what we should really take away from the quote is that's how powerful You're on Your Own Kid is.
Yeah,
it could even bring back Stevie Nicks and Taylor Swift after the humiliation that was the 2010 Grammys and the Rihanna Today Was a Fairy Tale mashup.
That's how powerful it is.
We couldn't do that. After the 15 performance with Miley Cyrus at the Grammys, there's nothing that are bringing – it's not bringing them together.
They
I'll
haven't
tell you
been
that for
brought
free.
Together.
No.
And these are the songs that they selected for Taylor Swift. Did they also vote on the songs? Is that how that worked? Or did the New York Times just pick them? So they picked Our Song, I'm Fucking Cheering, 15, Love Story, Dear John, Mirror Ball. I think that's a really interesting selection of songs because there's a very specific type of Taylor Swift song that is not mentioned in this list. Like A Cruel Summer, A Blank Space. There's no big pop moment there. I think that's an interesting, I actually think it's a bit of an oversight. Where's Cruel Summer?
Well, there's also no eldest daughter, but...
but we knew that. that. Most of those songs are from her first three albums.
Which actually, I think, is a little bit I'm Not Like Other Girls of New York Times.
Wait, All Too Well not being on that is fucking crazy. That is crazy.
They said what they said.
They put 15. I was happy to see 15 there.
Well, I wouldn't bump anything off of that list to put All Too Well there. Mm-mm. So
you can pry Dear John out of my cold, dead hands.
Yeah, and I've always said Dear John, better written.
It is. It's a better song. I mean, they're all good. Don't.
They're
all good.
Listen, I think we all sing. I think we all sing.
We all sing. Is there anything you would want to add in there? If you could add like more, is there anything that you would want to put in? Other than the Fate of Ophelia, which I know you want to put in.
I would gag to put Wishlist in there, but I think there's a lot that I would add in, but there's none that like, oh my God, I can't believe they left this off. If you say Dear John, you may pass go and you may collect $100.
I think we've come to a place where style is now underrated.
Which is crazy. Actually, and this has been something that I've been noticing ever since the Eras. Oh, excuse me.
What?
Ever since the Eras Tour, I bumped the microphone. Ever since the Eras Tour ended, we said all throughout the Eras Tour, there is no such thing as an underrated Taylor song anymore.
Wrong.
Because every surprise song has a fucking shooter. And now, it's been like a year plus, almost 2 years, right, since the Eras Tour ended.
So we can see.
So we can really see, like, people are starting to sleep on these so-called songs that they so-called loved so-called so much.
Well, Taylor's always so-called performing style and never doing it in full. What's that about?
And I think that really so-called speaks to the the so-called fact that she doesn't so-called respect it.
No, it's a bit of a so-called shame that she's doing that. Like, that's not good at all.
No, it isn't. And there's a lot of songs that I'm really starting to, like, they're falling off.
And we need to bring them back.
But actually, it makes me really happy because it kind of makes me feel like I'm on my high horse. When I say Come In With the Rain is one of the greatest songs ever made.
And no one agrees.
A joined 2023 says, who? I'm like, that's
exactly.
What I thought.
You were liking it for clout during the Eras Tour. You're
that's
not streaming it now. You're not streaming it now.
That's what
also,
I
was really pleased to see Our Song. The more that time goes on, the more I'm like, Our Song is one
made.
Of her best songs. I'm actually here to say on this day that Our Song is the best song on debut.
Somebody has to say it.
I'm saying it.
And I would, in terms of longevity, if nothing else, I think we have to agree with that.
It's so hard because, to me, the trifecta for debut is Our Song, Teardrops, and Tim McGraw. Like, those songs are all classic Taylor Swift songs. But Our Song, to me, the good thing about it for debut is that it really hints at where she's going in the future because it's so poppy. It really is a pop song.
It is. It's one of the greatest country pop songs ever made.
The part at the end, on his window, that's Shakespeare. And I love how she went into that in the interview, too. I loved when she went into Our Song and she was talking about it's very important to her how words sound. Shows to me that it's not just the lyrics, babe. She's a melodic songwriter.
Yeah, and I think that's the first time she's ever said something like that.
We've been needing this.
Well, something that I'd like to point out is, like, one of our favorite things, and I think many Swifties' favorite things, is when she talks about the writing. She doesn't do it that much. I'm not saying she's never done it. I mean, we have the folklore studio sessions. We have, I think, Journey to Fearless, she talked about songwriting a little bit. We have Making of the Song. We have Miss Americana when she's doing Lover. Like, we have little bits and bobs, but, like, I think this is the longest time she ever just sat and talked about how she writes songs.
It is. For any sustained
20 years.
Point. It's crazy.
It's crazy.
The only time I remember her doing this is, do you remember when she would do for like Billboard or Good Morning America? Back in
yes.
the day, she would do a little like a tight 2 or 3 minutes on every song on the album. The one for Red is so good. If you've never heard it, go and listen to it. She doesn't fully get into the songwriting, but she at least gives like a focused attention to what the song is, what it's about, and kind of how I wrote it. I think there was a really good breadth of songs brought up here. Joe Coscarelli, who's the host of the podcast that you like,
yeah.
He did the interview and he did a really good job.
He's a genius. Popcast.
Joe.
You changed everything.
We cheer for you.
Constantly raising the bar.
We
cheer.
We need a lot of this. Now, if you're a true blue Swiftie, a lot of this is information you already know, but it was still nice to hear her string all of the thoughts together. Of course, because it's Taylor, there were some randomista segues. But we love that.
Well, we absolutely love that.
Well, let's get into it. Where do you want to start?
So let's start with the very first thing that she says. The thing about the way that the interview is structured is that you don't hear the question.
Mm-hmm.
You just have her talking. I'm assuming that the question is, how do you write songs? Or what is songwriting to you, period. And she says, it's still such a mystery to me. Even though I've been writing songs for so long and I've started songs and finished songs so many different ways, they've gone through so many journeys, they've happened quickly, they've happened over time, they've been inspired by my life, by mythology, by fables, by Toy Story, by books, by movies, by characters, by warnings,
by lessons. Netflix movie and not Joe Alwyn breaking up with me.
And they never quite happen exactly the same way, and I still don't quite understand how it works. I think this is one of my favorite things that she says in the interview, because it's like there's a mysticism and a mystery to like how a song comes to exist, and she talks about it almost as if it is
divine,
a power that she has been gifted but that she doesn't understand. It's like it comes through her, obviously, but she doesn't get where it comes from, and it still amazes her. She's amazed by her own work, as she should be.
As she should be, because it's amazing. And sometimes the ideas that come through, the signal gets a little whoop. she gets fat ass and a baby face, and it's like that's when we need to go, okay, not today. I'm turning it off for today. But you can't turn off being tapped into the divine.
You can't.
It's always going to be there for you. I love it how she kind of describes it almost as a religious process. Like it is something she's committed to and inspired by. And I think people forget that as well. Like Taylor is always writing, even when she's promoing and doing stuff like that. Like these ideas are constantly coming to her. You can't just turn it off when you're promoting stuff.
Yeah.
She always
has to write.
She's always posting.
I have this very strong opinion that when you're young, you feel things on such an intense and detailed level. There's an attention to detail when you're 17 to 22 years old and you're longing or you're reaching and grasping but never holding someone's attention or someone's love or someone's dedication, and you just can't understand why you spend all day thinking about it. You notice everything. You know this candle ash on the cuff of the shirt and the button, and it's everything that makes the mythology of those intense feelings that you have. And I've always tried to, without being a completely unhinged adult, keep that level of detail and intensity when it comes to trying to describe a feeling.
That is so interesting to me when we get to Life of a Showgirl. I'm sorry I had to keep coming back to it when I was thinking about the interview, because attention to detail.
If there's one thing I feel like nobody can really argue with, like whether you're the Showgirl number one fan or you're the Showgirl number one hater, it is very removed from detail.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredibly removed from detail. It is vague in a way, and I feel like she really was trying to tap into that 1989 songwriting. And 1989 isn't as detailed as like a Red or a Speak Now. Like, we can definitely say that. But like, there's something about the lack of anything, almost lack of explanation.
Substance kind of is the word that comes
to mind. You know, fat ass and a baby face. When people are arguing ardently about like, is she serious or is she not serious? In Wishlist, like,
you missed the
it's
the
not
bullseye.
Being explained well enough, and normally she's very good at being concise in her lyrics, so that's,
it's a moment of questionista.
We're questioning it,
but that is part of what makes her such a great songwriter overall, is her commitment and her attention to detail. And something I found when I was doing my like reaction to it is that she's living the writer's life. You're a writer everywhere you go, and I think you have to be really tuned in and tapped into the inspiration and the work of doing it. That's another thing that really came through in this interview to me, was like, she always comes to a session with a plan in mind and something to do. She doesn't show up and go, well, what the hell we gonna do now? And you can tell by listening to some people that they show up to the studio and they say, what the hell we gonna do now?
Who are you talking about?
The Kid Laroi. He shows up and goes, what the hell we gonna do now? And they get ChatGPT
that is
on it.
Such a random. I didn't know what name was going to come out of your mouth.
Well,
not the Kid Laroi.
Do you protest?
No, I don't protest at all. I don't know enough about his music to say that, but I believe it. Mm-hmm. I believe it 100%. I know Tate McRae, as a comparison, walks into the studio and says, girls, let's make magic.
Mm-hmm.
Does he do that? Absolutely not.
No, he doesn't. He definitely doesn't.
He doesn't.
But I love that. I love to hear about the inspiration and the work and the follow through.
Period. So up next is a section called Early Influences. I started writing songs when I was 12. As soon as my love for singing and picking up an instrument happened, songwriting just spontaneously started becoming the entire cornerstone of my life, which is a crazy thing to say, but she's so true and she's so right. And she should keep saying it. It needs to keep being the cornerstone. Has it been the cornerstone recently?
We have to stop.
I'm sorry to everyone listening. It's just the low-hanging fruit.
It's the
and
low-hanging
it's right
fruit.
There. And you know what? We're going to start reaching for higher branches. I'm sorry.
No, we are. And we are. I'll say something about that. I think a lot of the times people really get it twisted with her. They think that the purpose or what she's focused on is the romance and the mining the romance for clues. Really, she's obsessed with writing. That's her entire – I think that it occupies a lot of her private time. She's not thinking about how, I'm sure she is thinking about how many variants can I make, but I think she's mostly thinking about what can I do to really explain however this like bolt of inspiration struck me today. What's the best way that I can channel it into being something?
Period. And I think that two things can be true at the same time. We can be obsessed with the charts and we can also be the songwriter of the generation.
Yes!
Like she's somebody who she's
not everyone can do that.
Not everyone can do that.
Ed Sheeran can't do that.
No, he can't do Azizam.
No.
And
Lana Del Rey can do Greatest Songwriter of the Generation, but she can't do Chart Obsessed.
No, she can't. The James Bond song, I think, was the closest we've come to like a Lana Del Rey, This Could Be on the Radio song.
That shocked me.
And I'm not going to say anything more about that.
Oh, at the end, we should look at Lana's recommended songs, like what their top five Lana songs are.
I'm
very curious to see what they would pick. Anyway, back to Taylor Swift.
I think the first songs that I fell in love with were the type of songwriting that folk and country is really known for. It's that story time structure. Songs like Harper Valley PTA or Goodbye Earl by the Chicks or any amazing Kenny Chesney song. A hypothetical structure would be first verse, a little girl learns a lesson that in the chorus her mom teaches her about. Then the little girl grows up and now she's a teenager and she realizes, oh my god, my mom was right about this. Now the second time you hear the hook, the same hook means something a little bit different because she's grown up in her life. Then the bridge, maybe she goes on in her life. And you know what song I was thinking of as she was describing this? Emily comes home from school.
Oh my god, that's a deep cut. Everybody needs to look up Brought Up That Way right now.
And that, it was so interesting hearing her describe, like, the formulaic country classic, like, 80s, 90s country classic songwriting style. Because if you think about a song, like, specifically Mary's Song is the one that always comes to mind when she talks about this kind of songwriting. She was doing the formula, but she was doing it in a way that, to me, as, like, a 12, 13-year-old girl, I didn't want to listen to whatever song she's describing.
Mm-hmm.
I want to listen to a 16-year-old girl talk about, wouldn't it be amazing if I could find a husband?
Well, that's actually so – that's so true.
It's so true.
And
that's what I wanted.
Part of what Taylor's really was innovative for, and I think she doesn't get a lot of credit for, was that, like, not only was she a pioneer of, you know, being a young girl in country music, she also really introduced a new way of songwriting. As in, she wasn't letting men come in and write songs about what being a teenage girl was and selling those. She was being like, I'm going to write to the divas that are my age because right. I know what they want to hear better than you do, genius. I know more about American Girl dolls than you. And she really, I guess, pioneered a new form of country and pop songwriting.
She did.
That was totally of her own making. Like, what she did at the beginning of her career is so different to, like, how a Disney Channel star starts being an artist, for example, where they get a product or they get a treatment and they just execute it. I'm not saying that that's wrong, but Taylor definitely is so unique in the way that creative control was baked into her whole thing before she even started.
And I think we really have to raise a glass up to Taylor specifically, but also to the people around her, her parents and the people who supported her. Like, she could have just become a songwriter who gave her songs away, but like she staunchly refused to do that. She said, no, give me time. Let me get better. I can do this. And I can write. I don't want somebody else singing my songs.
And one could see why if you met 13-year-old Taylor, you might say, maybe someone else needs to sing this.
The Dorkosaurus was leaping.
Well,
and
also,
you know
the bad Singosaurus was leaping. Those early demos are really, I'm every woman.
Taylor, another glass we should raise up because she has worked so hard on her vocals over the years. The jump between
Mariah Carey's debut now. And
Fearless, and then the jump between Fearless and like Red, from Red to 1980, on and on. Like, she has constantly worked on her vocals. She always had a nugget there, mm-hmm. but like she knew and she's known it always. I'm not Mariah Carey. I'm not Beyonce. I don't have a natural gift. All I do is try. I need to get my ass up. I need to learn how to use my voice. I can't sing like other people. I have to sing like Taylor. And she was the bad Singosaurus, but I think we can all agree now
she's the good Singosaurus.
She's the good Singosaurus. And I love her voice for what she makes. And I can't imagine another voice singing her songs. That's why I hate the babe version of Sugarland. I hate it.
I always think it's so silly when people say, like, they do these compilations of Taylor singing badly because they're always old clips, first of all. They're always clips from, like, the latest one they have is 1989 at the VMAs. And it's like, girls, she wasn't trying to sing. That was not the point of what she was doing in that specific moment. But Taylor's not – again, she's not a bad singer. I don't even think she's, like, an okay singer. I think she's a pretty good singer for what she does. She works pretty hard. Her breath control has gotten really good.
Oh, yeah.
She she knows, she really respects the limitations of her instrument.
Calling it an instrument is exactly that. You know, if you know, Beyonce has, you know, a clarinet, Taylor has a flute.
Or
you know
a recorder. What I mean?
Yeah.
And it's the most beautiful, glittery recorder in the world. I love the recorder, but it's a recorder.
But
to
have
Beyonce's
you seen
horn.
These like really professional, like Broadway style singers try to sing Taylor songs, and they really struggle
with it.
They botch
them, yeah,
because it's she sings them in such a specific way. When you try to put that, you can't do that.
They're her stories. There's a conversational element to a Taylor Swift song.
Well, you can't do Summer Went Away.
No, you can't.
Still the only
Well, if you want to hear an example of this, look at the Cynthia Erivo cover of I Did Something Bad. That's crazy.
A hit.
But it was better when Taylor did it.
Period.
Light me up.
Okay, moving on. But then with lyricism, I was the most intensely impacted by emo music. Dashboard Confessional, Chris Carrabba, Fall Out Boy, Pete Wentz's lyrics. How they take a common phrase and then they just twist the knife of it. This was really interesting because we were just talking about this. Was it 2019 Part 3 that we were talking about? She references Pete Wentz as like one of her songwriting idols.
And we were like, what does that mean? Why?
And it's like I tried to explain it. This explains it so much better. She loves his turn of phrase, which is like what he was known for. His stylization of songwriting, it like all emo that came after it for a certain period of time, like everybody was trying to write like Pete Wentz. And you can't.
Can I ask for an example? Because I'm not clued into emo music at all. It really was not my vibe. Can you give me an example of a turn of phrase that like is really signature him?
One of the most famous ones would be, I'll be your number one with a bullet, a loaded God complex, cock it and pull it.
Oh,
so it's like
okay.
He's like very, he takes common phrases and he fucks with them.
Taylor loves to do that.
And she loves that. And it's like, I guess that's where that inspiration comes from, is from Pete Wentz. The Old Testament Fall Out Boy, like his songwriting was crazy. Like when you really like, if the sound isn't for you, I would recommend that you read the lyrics because they're insane. Like,
yeah, I need to read.
Psychotic.
I need to read.
Nonetheless, I thought the fact that she's still bringing it up 26 years later, and also after she put him on that terrible Speak Now.
No, yeah, you did this to your hero. You did this to your hero. You put them on Electric Touch. Well, to be fair, what else did she have to put them on? You can't put Pete Wentz on Foolish One.
You can't put Pete Wentz on Foolish One. You can't put Patrick Stump on Foolish One.
I'm saying put them on Timeless. I think we could have done something camp with
that. Could have been something really, really camp about like a punk, like a Misery Business style.
Version of Timeless.
Let them do it.
I'm interested in, or When Emma Falls in Love.
Actually,
punk version of When Emma Falls in Love.
That would be really cute. Like, unironically.
She's so New York when she's in LA.
It would go
yeah.
crazy. That's
I'm
actually
ready.
Such a pop punk lyric because it makes no sense.
No. It makes no sense.
But it's a vibe.
Did you
it's
listen
vibe.
To Dashboard Confessional? Was that kind of, did you like
I
that?
Was distantly, you know, I like, you know, Hands Down. That's the one that she's like, Hands Down is the greatest song
is
ever
that the
made.
One that she got them to come sing at
yes.
Abigail's party?
It's a classic. Also, Screaming Infidelities, everybody knew that song, acoustic, Screaming Your Lungs Out. They were a certain brand of like acoustic driven emo that was kind of not for me necessarily, and I also hate his voice secretly.
Did she mention any women when she was talking about this particular moment?
No, where's Hayley Williams?
Taylor?
Where's Amy Lee from Evanescence? Where's Hayley Williams?
Where's Avril Lavigne?
Where's Avril Lavigne? No.
Where's Britney?
No.
When it comes to songwriting, maybe not Britney.
Maybe not Britney, but
Avril definitely, though.
I think we definitely could have thrown in a Hayley Williams memento because I think
she said it before, too.
Yeah, I think that Hayley Williams, especially now, I mean, if we look at what Hayley's doing now, her songwriting does, like, have a point of view. And, like, when you're coming up in pop punk, sometimes you just get shuffled into the genre, and it's like, oh, this is just like everybody else. But as Paramore really grew and, like, came into their own, they had a unique stylization of writing their songs.
The Hayley
and, like,
Williams footprint is yeah. really clear.
And it's because there was a woman in the band. Mm-hmm. So let's just know that.
Taylor, my takeaway from this interview also is more women mentioned, please.
Yeah, especially when you're doing Bitches, Bitches, Bitches on the album.
And then going, I Love Somber, and ignoring your alleged understudy, Gracie Abrams, or Sabrina Carpenter, or literally anyone else.
Or literally anyone else.
Anyway, we'll get to that.
So there's similar influences. And then she talks about her Nashville storytelling roots. This is kind of like the heart and soul of what still makes a Taylor Swift song. She says, I think one of my favorite things about the Nashville music scene, country music and its storytelling, when I arrived there, she keeps, I don't know if you noticed this in the interview, she kept saying back then, like she has an issue with it now, but it's like, we can't even get into that because I don't really know what she's talking
about. I
want to
know, though.
I'm not as in tune with the country music scene. Maybe she's secret in code talking about Morgan Wallen.
Or
she's saying, see me at Whole
Ella
Foods,
Langley,
bitch.
Ella Langley, I don't want to meet you.
Yeah, I don't want to meet Ella Langley, et cetera, et cetera. Nonetheless, when I arrived there, there was this tradition of breaking the fourth wall, making the song a part of the song, or the writing of the song becomes a part of the song. And I did that in a song called Tim McGraw, where I'm singing about this love lost and hoping that person thinks of me. And then in the bridge, it's revealed that I wrote this song and I hope he hears it. The song Our Song, which I still love so much, is all about this romance, this relationship. And then the end, it says, I grabbed a pen and an old napkin and I wrote down Our Song. So I love doing that, and I kind of still love doing that, just like, and it was me. And I knew she was going to bring up The Last Great American Dynasty when she brought that
up. Oh, exactly.
One of the greatest.
I knew where she was going almost instantaneously. And when she said, I loved performing it on stage, I would like grin from ear to ear. I was like, we knew that. We saw it.
We saw it every night. And then it was Bob by me.
You're an adult. You should know that.
You're an adult. You should know that.
No, she does love to do that. And honestly, I remember, I will never forget hearing that line in The Last Great American Dynasty for the first time. Thank God it's on camera. That gagged me to hell and back. I was immediately like, she's fucking genius. And she hadn't done it in a while.
No, and that's what made it so gaggy. Another great one that I think is underrated is Invisible String.
Oh, yes. That
Cold
is.
Cold was the steel of my axe to grind for the boys who broke my heart. Now, everybody knows what she means.
No, we gagged.
That, the folklore listening session, day one.
No, I was in tears almost. I was like, we're so back. After Lover, I was like, we're so back. That's why I'm so excited for whatever comes after the live show.
We can't help it.
It's going to be so, it's gonna be so good. It's going to be so good. I can't wait.
It's going to be amazing. And I'm really looking forward to that kind of a moment again.
And then it was bought
and
by me.
And then it was bought by me. I also have to, like, I like when she thinks she's like really shocking people.
Yeah.
And she is. I'm saying that she is.
I was
is.
Still shocked when the reveal came. I didn't know what the fuck she was talking about. But at that point, like, I didn't really get what folklore was. It was track three. I was still like, who are we talking about? What is this subject matter?
Cardigan was especially mystifying.
It still is.
It's still. We still haven't.
We're still mystified.
We still haven't even really gotten into it. But The Last Great American Dynasty, I think that was the moment when I recognized, oh, I'm kind of starting to get what this album is going to be. But The Last Great American Dynasty has a really perfect place on the track list because you're like, okay, I get it. Mm-hmm. She's telling stories, and maybe these stories are about her. Maybe they're not.
Maybe they have something tangentially to do with her.
Exactly. And then it was bought by me.
And then it was bought by me. No, it really, it's too good. You know what really a song that could have been improved by a turnaround? The Lucky One. If The Lucky One had a fourth wall break, that actually could have sent it into a different dimension. I think, you know, we have our theory that she was being restrained about what was going on, Red, subject matter-wise. Nothing new exists as the foil to The Lucky One. But I think if we were going to workshop the song The Lucky One, it could really benefit from a turn.
I think it could benefit from a turn. She almost does it. And she says, and they tell me now I'm the lucky one.
But she stops it there.
But she stops it there. And it's like, it's, again,
elaborate,
nothing,
mama?
It's nothing new watered down.
She was like, I don't want to say I've had too much.
She's scared. She wanted to talk about Joni Mitchell, but whatever.
Thank God she didn't.
Then she gets into People Slept on that song. And she starts saying some interesting things here. So she says, I've learned you can't ever really tell if other people are going to like it. But oftentimes when I love it to a certain degree, that kind of tends to match up with people.
Right.
Delusional. And it could be that it doesn't match up with the way people feel until 6 years later. I loved the Reputation album. I was
yes!
like, you guys say what you want. I know what I did. I love it. Go with God. Sorry. You can come around if you want. It's okay if you don't. My problem with this is that you were on camera crying when you discovered that people didn't like it.
It's true.
Remember when it didn't get nominated for a Grammy and you immediately turned on it and said, I'm making a better record?
And she also not only turned on it like that, Lover was a complete rejection of Reputation. Everything about it, its sonic styling, the way that she did the songs, the way that she produced it, it was completely different. So it is, she definitely is doing a lot of revisionist history in this interview, which is fine. It's her story to tell, and how she wants to tell it is up to her. But we know the truth. Some of us were there.
She turned on Reputation.
And also, can I just say, I think she really said, she didn't explicitly say this, but she puts that in there to make the point. she wants to say this is going to happen to Life of a Showgirl. It's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. Because when Reputation came out, it got mixed reviews. It didn't get negative reviews. I don't know what she's talking about here. Like, the Pitchfork review and the New York Times review of Reputation are actually really good pieces of music criticism that give the album a lot of bones. Their main critique at the time was that it sounded a bit too trend hopping. Like, it, and when you listen to it back, it does sound like a very 2017 album. I personally love that. It's not an issue for me. But they pointed out that there was a lot of really interesting Taylor stuff going on. Like, Delicate was a very quick highlight. They said the songwriting was clever. The New York Times even said it was the most adventurous she would probably ever be. And that is a really interesting nugget in hindsight in terms of like sonic styling. They were like, this is probably the furthest she's ever going to push the boat out when it comes to experimenting with production. And I think that's true. So it's not the same. The Life of a Showgirl hasn't had that reception.
And the other thing about Life of a Showgirl, and specifically Reputation, is like Reputation had layers and you had to take it at face value and let everything fall away and like let her tell the story without all the bullshit. And for some people, they couldn't do that. They weren't ready to separate Reputation from the idea of Taylor that they had in their heads. That's why. And when she says people are gonna get it, yeah, randomistas, not your fans.
Randomistas.
We all got it from day one. Mm-hmm. And the thing about Showgirl, again, whether you're the number one stan or you're the number one hater,
not hard
in the world,
to get.
It's very on its face. And I feel like people always take that as like a criticism. 1989 is not hard to understand.
No. Just clear.
Speak Now isn't hard to understand.
Well, to some people it is.
But like there's not like layers that one day you're going to be like, it finally clicked and now I finally understand. It's like...
Lover has more layers than Life of Showgirl. It's been clicking to me recently.
Showgirl is very just like, this is what it is. If you haven't clicked on Showgirl in the last 7-8 months since it came out, it's never clicking.
You just don't like it, babe.
And that's okay.
That's okay. We're here to tell you.
But I don't...
Anyway.
that's what she's trying to get at. I think the first time I felt like, I don't care if people hate this because I love it so much, was when I wrote the song Love Story when I was 17, sitting in my bedroom mad at my parents because they wouldn't let me go on a date with a guy who was too old, so I shouldn't have been on a date with him anyway.
Say that.
And this is why you need to discipline your kids, because they might write songs that go number one.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.
And yet, I'm saying do it again.
Do it. Where's the number one love story?
For the plot.
I would like to see it.
I would like to see it.
I thought that was a really interesting song to pick, to say this is the one that I don't care if people don't like. I couldn't tell if she was saying that she thought people might not like it or if she was saying she felt like she wasn't allowed to write the song because of the experience she was having. How did you interpret it?
I interpreted it like when she was writing it, she was completely, she didn't care if her parents got mad, she didn't care.
She just loved it so much, she was like, it's going out.
Yeah, it's going out, it's going to be my single. I feel very confident about what I've created and I know it's good, is how I interpreted it.
The thing is now, I think she applies that approach to all songs that she makes. It's not like for the special ones.
Yeah, well.
Well, anyway.
Writing solo. And I'm saying, if there's one thing I think we need to kind of have a little 2020s experiment with, it's let's write another solo album. Mm-hmm. Just for fun. Let's just go for fun.
I'd like to see it.
When I wrote Speak Now, I was 18 and 19, and I was coming from this big, massive moment that I had with an album called Fearless. It had won Album of the Year at the Grammys, and it was the first time there was this big debate over whether I deserved to be there. There are always going to be little debates, but this was like headline news. I was like, these discussions can lead to a really bad place if I don't do something to counteract them. And to prove that, no, it wasn't my co-writers that did all this work. And yes, I am the author of this entire body of work that I was very proud of. I had written so many songs alone. I love collaboration. I love co-writers, but it's not something that I needed. It's when I started to trust myself as an editor, because a lot of what I'll do in a session, even now, and one of the reasons why Liz Rose and Jack Antonoff became people that I love to write with for albums and albums, is because I'll have the stream of consciousness pouring out and Liz would sit there with a notepad. But when you take that away, I just started recording everything on a voice memo, because there will be times where I'm kind of in a zone and I'm writing so fast that there's no chance I'm going to remember what that melody was that I did 2 minutes ago that I thought was cool for the verse. That was a really important album for me in terms of becoming a writer that knew I could trust my own intuition. And I'm saying, put the respect on the name.
Speak Now, finally getting her goddamn moment. I think Taylor understands that other people really love Speak Now. I don't think it's one of her favorites.
And that's demented to me. I think she thinks in her mind's eye
that Fearless is better.
That Fearless is better and that Red is better. It's sandwiched in between two records that I think she loves more. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not the writing, obviously, that she has an issue with. I think it's the way that it was produced, because she was in her very young 20s, and that's an age when you're like, I want to experiment. And like, people think that Red was the experimental album. It was Speak Now. On Speak Now, she was saying, I'm Pete Wentz. I'm Alanis Morissette.
She was pissed. It was a goth punk moment of female rage.
Yeah, she was putting on lots of different hats on that record. It's actually very all over the place.
Diverse.
She was doing Amy Lee from Evanescence. Like, she was being so many different women that she had grown up listening to, I think. Michelle Branch also, like, all the hats were being put on. And I think when she thinks of it now, she's like, I was kind of all over the place, but that's what makes it special to me and to many of the people who are Speak Now hats.
At least she knows. She knows what it means
to her. She knows. And it's like, it will always have that special place in her heart, because to this day, it's still the only solo write. It exists as like, this is proof that I don't need anybody else in the room to do my shit. And what's funny is that you can tell, because like, the songs are so long.
In a certain way, it's the single most important album she'll ever create until she does another album that she writes completely by herself. And for that reason, it has to stand alone.
I completely agree.
Thank you, Speak Now. We love you.
Thank you, Speak Now. You're
constantly, we're always speaking now on this podcast.
We have been speaking now for years. Mm-hmm. Up next, she talks about some of her language tricks that she uses in songs. She says, certain words just fly for me. And I think one of the reasons I like to take either age-old cautionary sorts of phrases or things you've heard in books, films, these classic lines, and then repurpose them, inverting them, or redefining them in some way, is because I sort of love the combination of modern vernacular and old world or classic timeless speak. Well, we knew that. With no one around to tweet it. And that's just a
Can I say, when she's talking about all her things that she loves about her songwriting, when she brings this up, I was truly mystified. I was like, it's not even like a technique or a skill. It's just a weird quirk that she likes to do. And I can't think of a time where I actually think that it improved the song. Can you?
Off the top of
Is it
my
great
head.
When we're doing Life Was a Willow and it bent right to your wind and she goes, I come back stronger than a 90s trend?
No.
No.
What's another time that she's done it? Okay, so Fate of a Field.
I Hate It Here. Does she do it in I Hate It Here? Without all the racists, but that's not really.
No.
She does it a lot on Life of a Showgirl, which is why she's bringing this up. I'm sorry, that's the only reason why.
And that's the worst example you can give. Mm-hmm. That's the really sad part. So then she says, in the song The Fate of Ophelia, there's a lot of modern terminology and common phrases from the way that we talk now. But there's also in the bridge a line from Hamlet that I repurposed. I really gravitate.
Silence in this studio right now.
I really gravitate toward juxtaposition and polarity in a line. This part is interesting, but I think it's really interesting that she thinks juxtaposition and polarity and no one around to tweet it is like so interesting. But it's like you do that in so many different ways. The modern versus old-timey is one of the least interesting ways that she does this.
Well, if it's also a juxtaposition is supposed to, by the contrast, help you reveal something about what you're trying to say by having these two things go against each other. What are we trying to say?
'Tis locked inside my memory.
Like, you just wanted to go Tay British. That's what you wanted to do. She should really call this the Tay British effect, because she's always doing Tay British when she does it.
No, she does. And it's very true, because she that transatlantic accent.
Tay ye old English.
Accent? I just came from Minnesota just then. The transatlantic
Ms. Palin
accent.
Joins the podcast.
The transatlantic accent is crazy, and it comes out specifically when she says, 'tis locked inside my memory. Or things of that ilk.
I don't want to hear it.
No, and as time goes on, there's times when I can really accept it. Like, no one around to tweet it. At least I know what at least it serves a purpose. I'm like, okay, I know what you're talking about.
Juxtaposition of modern and contemporary that works is Love Story. The concept of Love Story. It's
right.
Her, I'm rewriting Romeo and Juliet.
It's also not.
But she doesn't need to do Tae-y old English to make the point.
And she does it on Eldest Daughter, too. You know, like.
Get that out of my face. Everybody's so punk on the internet.
And she says, everything is memes and fucking off. I don't know the words.
Every hot take is cold as ice.
And she thinks it's Shakespeare.
Did you get the job?
So here's example she gives, more from Showgirl. She says, I really gravitate toward juxtaposition and polarity in a line. Hey, what could you possibly get for the girl who has everything and nothing all at once?
Is that a juxtaposition?
I don't think that it is.
I don't think she knows what juxtaposition is.
I think there isn't any on Showgirl.
So, she's like making it up.
I guess you could argue juxtaposition is in Wishlist because she's saying, you know, everybody wants this. But it juxtaposed that along the fact that I have everything.
That's it.
That's the juxtaposition.
But it's not this example.
No.
I'm here to hear about Elizabeth Taylor, but the way she brought it up is so redundant to me.
So then she says, because ultimately we're all filled with polarity, hypocrisy, these battling features and factors that make up our jagged personalities. True, but the two examples she gives are coming of age has come and gone. What could you possibly get for the girl who has everything and nothing all at once?
I actually don't really get what she's talking about here.
No, it's like she does do this thing, but it's like these are bad examples.
Yeah,
couldn't think of them off the top of her head, which is fine.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Whatever, you couldn't think of it.
Interesting. Our coming of age has come and gone. That's actually not a juxtaposition. That's a wordplay.
It's also not. It's not polarizing. So it doesn't have polarity.
You're saying we got older.
Wordplay. Yeah, it's. You might say it's Pete Wentz.
Actually, it is way more Pete Wentz than whatever it is she's talking
yeah.
here. I think she just realized that if she avoided mentioning anything about Showgirl whatsoever, it would be proving her haters wrong and proving her haters right. There's nothing that she hates more than proving her haters right.
And me either.
But she's like, I'm going to force you to think the life of a Showgirl is good.
And unfortunately, in this instance, she's not compelling me.
I wasn't won over.
No, I wasn't won over, so... Thank you so much, Taylor.
At least
Taylor.
She didn't bring up Eldest Daughter.
She knew she couldn't. Actually, I was thinking about that earlier today. I was like, she's defending a lot, but she's not defending Eldest Daughter.
She will die for the fate of Ophelia. She's going to die on
well,
that hill.
Well, and you know what? Maybe she has the right. It's the hit to end all hits. So it's like...
If you're going to hang your hat on one of the songs, maybe it's your biggest hit ever
Ophelia.
Made.
Maybe it should be Ophelia. So
and
I'm
people genuinely
do
love that song.
They do. And
don't mind it. I'm agnostic on that.
The only thing that I think about Ophelia... And I think it's a very fair point that I've seen a lot of people bring up with it is like, where is this going to stand against in history?
Blank Space.
5 years down the line against Blank Space, Shake It Off, I Knew Your Trouble, Love Story, Our Song.
It's kind of on the same level as Antihero to me in terms of like expertise and craft. Antihero's a little better, but like they're in the same family versus A Cruel Summer and A Blank Space, which are
timeless.
Supreme.
Timeless.
They could have been timeless.
Ophelia could have been timeless.
No, it couldn't. actually, that's not true, Ellen.
All right. So then she starts talking about one of her favorite songwriting things of all time, the bridge. I think the importance for me of a bridge, it just feels like we're painting a picture, we're setting a scene. We have this opportunity as a songwriter to tell an entire story, an entire movie, or a very detailed description of one scene in a movie, or a very nuanced dynamic between people, or a complicated emotion, and we have only so long to do this. You know, I've written some really long songs in my life, but for the most part, they're between 3.5 and 4 minutes. You can start painting the picture in the verse, you can get to the heart of it at the chorus, but then the bridge can be where you zoom back, walk 20 feet back, and you see what the entire painting was supposed to be. You've seen brushstrokes, you've seen the color tones, but the bridge can be when you step back and feel everything that that piece of art was supposed to make you feel. That's just how I feel about bridges.
Well,
you know
yes.
What song does this really well, and was the first song I thought of when she said this, is Chloe or Sam. Can we watch our phantoms like watching wild horses?
Don't get me started.
Cooler in theory, but not if you force it to be. It just didn't happen. That's it.
Tortured Poets really has some of her most incredible zoom out 20 feet bridges.
LOML. You should tuck me under the table, tucking rings and tucking cradles. I wish I could recall how we almost had it all.
But Daddy, I Love Him too.
It's just over. Torture Poets really is, like, a lot of the songwriting things that she's talking about that she loves there. About songwriting, she does on Torture Poets.
Oh, I guess How Did It End is kind of an example of her Tay British thing that she likes to do, the juxtaposition of ye olde Tay English. And
yeah, but it goes crazy. See, that's a moment where I'm saying she nailed it.
Yeah.
Because she commits fully. It's not just randomly. 'Tis locked inside my memory.
No, it's
the
like
song
a full
opens with, we hereby conduct this postmortem. She's, like, committed to the bit. And The Lakes is like that, too. Without the tweet it line, The Lakes is actually a really good example of that as well.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So there you go.
Torture Poet's not mentioned enough in this interview.
No.
She doesn't want to talk about it.
And
it's like Lover and Reputation. She was like, I'm done with that. It's over. Now we're doing the fun thing. Don't ask me about the sad thing.
Now we're doing the fun thing. But you know what? She's talking 5-6 years. The album that people need 5-6 years to cook on is called Torture Poet's Department.
That's
maybe
what
she
I've
needs 5-6 years, too.
She
needs
does.
5-6 years of Reputation. Now she needs 5-6 years of Torture Poets, and I'll be waiting.
I'll
when
be there.
Everybody wakes up to the reality. I'll be here.
I'll be on my Mardi Gras throat float, throwing out beats from my float, saying, but Daddy,
Poets,
I love him.
But Daddy, I love him. Thank you.
I do love when she talked about Clara Bow, though. That was a great example of what she was
that
specifically talking about.
That was a great example.
Jack Antonoff and Taylor are not fighting. He was mentioned multiple times.
He was mentioned multiple times, and I'm saying, thank God, I was never in either camp. Because I thought it was really, really strange. And I was like, that just doesn't make sense to me. After how many years of being not just, like, very close friends, but, like, your signature is on so much of my work. It's like, they could have had a dust-up, but, like, we're not friends anymore and we're never going to talk. I was like, there's no way that's happening.
They also had the main critique coming away from Torture Poets was get away from Jack Antonoff for a second. So I think this was also just part of her recalibration of Showgirl. She was like, I'm just going to put this one down for a minute. Like with Max Martin, she put him down for a bit and came back to it.
He'll be back.
He'll be back. And we'll be waiting.
He'll be back. But everybody wants a slice of Aaron Dessner.
Everyone.
On his Instagram, he's posting, I'm so excited to announce I worked with Noah Kahan. I'm so excited to announce I work with Gracie Abrams. I'm so excited to work with this random person you've never heard of. It's like,
you see how Taylor gave him a job?
She gives a lot of people many jobs, and that's why she's charitable.
And that's why they'll
Aaron
never get
Dessner,
mad at her.
You're a special guy. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Queenie.
So up next, they have this whole section where they just say, talk about Mirrorball. And I'm
yes!
for it. So she says, the Mirrorball Bridge, this was Jack sending me a track during COVID and me immediately knowing that it needed to be about how I felt as a performer and an entertainer within this moment when entertainment and art has effectively shut down. Sidebar, really quick. The fact that that existed as a track first before she ever said the word Mirrorball, and she heard the track and the way the guitar is and heard a Mirrorball.
Tay genius.
Is why she's the genius to end
Tay
all
genius.
Geniuses. Like, that's
heard,
a level.
It's the school dance.
Yep. She heard it.
Mm-hmm.
Jack probably hadn't even been thinking about that at all.
That was Dark Side
he
of the Gym if
it slayed. He might have described it probably. It's hard not to describe that as shimmering, but, like, it's perfectly, specifically a mirror ball shimmer. It's crazy. She's a genius. She's a fucking genius.
Hey, genius. We've been knowing it.
So,
she's locked inside mine.
This is
the
so
vocal stim. We found our first tour vocal stim, guys.
Oh, okay. I'm still going to stand on this tightrope. I'm still up on the trapeze. I'm still going to try to do tricks for you. But at the same time, being a person in the public eye, I've really begun to realize that you are a mirror. You are a mirror for your fans, for the media, for people on the internet, for just random people who don't even really care about your music, but they know who you are. However they feel about themselves and their life will be projected onto how they perceive you. A public person who makes art is a mirror ball. And that's part of why I've been able to keep my wits about me through all of this, because I know that, and I'm really aware of that dynamic. But I'm still endlessly fascinated by people, by the human experience, by why people are the way they are, by the ways they feel emotion. I think that's what keeps us connected.
Mirrorball is like the best kind of self-referential meta writing about pop stardom, because she finds a way to make you feel like it relates to you, because she understands, okay, I feel this way because I'm a pop star and the lights are off and I have no one to perform for and I lose my sense of self. But that's kind of how we all felt in the pandemic. Like, performance is not just something you do on a stage. It's
right.
Something that you do every day when you interact with other people. So I think she found like her best – the best moments of Taylor Swift's songwriting are when she finds a connection to an experience that is a universal human emotion. And that feeling we all felt at the time, I don't know, like Mirrorball is an incredible song, but it's made so much more resonant by the context of when it was released mm-hmm. and why she felt that way.
Yeah, it was just geniosity from start to finish.
I know she wrote that the day that Loverfest was officially canceled. She was like, yep.
What the hell am I going to do
what
now?
What the hell are we going to do now? My man hates me. And now I have to stay at home with him for 2 years. I can't even go to work to get away.
Stuck with him.
But I can. I'll make a studio in my house and force him to do it with me.
That's exactly what she did. Queen She's genius. You can make these shockingly vulnerable confessions within a song like, I've never been a natural. All I do is try, try, try. I remember writing that and being like, oh my God, this feels like, do you want to say this? And I'm like, actually, I feel like a lot of people feel that way. That always overrides my discomfort within the line feels too true, because I don't really think that there's anything that's too true.
That's not true, Ellen. Why wasn't Nothing New on Red?
Well, we know why.
Well, sidebar, a lot of people are saying after the All Too Well discussion in this interview, they're saying all the Vault tracks are fake. And I'm saying, you're cracked.
You can't say that.
You're saying 2021 Taylor Swift wrote Message in a Bottle. You're demented. You've lost the plot. You've lost the plot.
Because we have been sort of investigating these Vault tracks and we've been quandering. Some of them we can ask that question, but do you really think When Emma Falls in Love was written in 2024?
Do you really think that? You think that Folklore Evermore Taylor wouldn't go into that and have something else to say? Timeless? Some of them are so, like, I'll hand it to you. Like, a song to me that I think may have had a little bit of tweak was Is It Over Now?
Oh, for sure, because it's so...
Is It Over Now is so Midnight's coded.
But
now that we don't talk, there's a demo of that, and right. It's exactly the same.
The thing about All Too Well is that, like, I feel like, as a Swiftie, as a fan, I could tell immediately that parts of that song were not written in 2012. Fuck the patriarchy.
She just wasn't saying that. She wasn't saying
fuck the patriarchy, keychain on the ground.
That was part of her whole problem.
She was there's something about the song that feels so much more reflective than just this happened 4 months ago or 3 months ago. It feels like this happened years ago.
It makes All Too Well 10 more interesting to me because it's so emblematic of what the Taylor's Version project was. It's I'm myself that has gone through so many things and I'm going back to my younger self, right, and seeing what the difference between us is. And all the added parts of All Too Well, the specific parts that I think really, really weren't there is the I'll get older, but your lovers will stay my age. You don't realize that when you're young and it's happening to you. You think that you're special. You think that you're the one that's going to be different. And as you get older, you realize that. But again, I'm not hating on All Too Well 10 being constructed because I think it's a beautiful continuation of what it was. It adds so much to the story.
She tells this whole story in the interview about, like, because the old story was like she recorded a 10-minute version that was just a rant during soundcheck and, you know, she kept it from us and she whittled it down to be a real song. But the real story is, like, she was in soundcheck. Yes, she was on her guitar fiddling around and it went on for 10 minutes. But the way that she describes it in the interview was like, there were some things I just didn't want to say. I can imagine she got very specific. Mm-hmm. Like, you did this on this night, and that made me want to fucking kill you, and, like, this X, Y, and, like, very specific. And she had to take it. It wasn't a song, is essentially what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. It was, I am ranting and raving into the void, and I don't care if anybody hears me. I'm minding my own business. And then she took that, brought it to Liz Rose, and said, let's fuck with this and, like, turn it into a real song.
I think so. Also, I think some of what she said there probably went into I Bet You Think About Me.
Oh, I bet so. I bet some of that stuff. And I Bet You Think About Me, that's one that you can really tell why it was kept back, because it was so...
cutting.
And also she was doing, I'm writing your name down in my burn book.
and she was trying not to do that at the time.
She was trying not to do that. Well, I'm saying keep writing it
All
down,
Too Well
girl.
10 is mad and sad, but I Bet You Think About Me is just mad.
And I like when she says that this was the most extensive restoration process I've ever done on a song. It's such an interesting way to think of it, like restoring an art piece.
I actually love thinking about it that it's an artifact that you have to go through carefully and reconstruct parts of that have been lost to the sands of time.
It's such an interesting way to think about it. It's almost like a building. All Too Well is like a building, and we're going in and we're, like, fixing all the beams and, like, putting it all back together.
But in a historically accurate way.
In a historically accurate way, but also it's not the same thing anymore.
And she knows that.
And she knows that.
I liked to hear that she was finally being honest about it, because I don't think she'd ever fully said before that the recording didn't exist. That was a first-time admission.
And we have to cheer.
And we knew it. Some of us, can I just say, some of us knew that and were persecuted relentlessly for years.
Yeah, I remember back in the day when it was like a old wives' tale, definitely around 1989, Reputation era, I started to say, you guys know it doesn't exist.
No, we kept being like, stop asking for it because it's not real. It's like the Red Tour DVD. It doesn't exist.
This was one time when if things had gone a different way, if the masters had never been bought, if this had gone in any way more favorable for her, All Too Well 10 would never have existed.
No, she would never have. I guess she got to read Taylor's version and was like, damn, okay, I really, you have to think about it as a marketing tool, the decision to go in and rework All Too Well. I'm sure she understood. She was like, this is a piece of lore that my fans are really going to love. It's also my most critically acclaimed song. The smartest possible thing I could do would be to act as though I have found this new complete thing in the vault, and that will bring the Taylor's version project to new stratospheres. And she was right.
Red Taylor's version was like the most, I don't want to say most successful, because I think 1989 sold 10 billion copies or something like that, but the Red Taylor's version was the most era.
She put her whole Red-ussy into it.
She did. She like made it into a whole moment, and we have to cheer.
Deserved. Tay Genius.
Tay Genius. So up next, she talks about how songs begin, and she tells a story about how she went to dinner with Travis and was telling Travis that she likes Elizabeth Taylor. And
what kills me is that it sounds like she explained to him for the first time who Elizabeth Taylor was.
He didn't know.
No, like, because she was doing things like she had violet eyes, and I feel like everybody knows that.
He doesn't know that. He doesn't know that. And that's okay.
That's okay. That's okay. He's a straight man that plays football. I'm kind of not surprised.
I discovered that the Cleopatra, her version of Cleopatra, is 4 fucking hours long.
It is.
I'm not watching that.
It's one of the most cursed movies ever made.
I wanted to watch it in preparation for Life of a Showgirl. Thank God I didn't.
That would have been a complete waste of time as well. You would have been so mad.
But Elizabeth Taylor is a great song, but it's not worth watching Cleopatra over. I'll tell you that for free. But I was just thinking, like, Travis isn't watching the 4-hour Cleopatra. I don't know
and
what.
And neither is Taylor. Neither is Taylor.
She's never seen that. I've only seen it in clips, and I think I've seen enough. They bankrupted everybody.
They bankrupted,
bankrupted everybody. But anyway, so she's telling this whole story, and she's like, oh, I have the intrusive melody of I Cried My Eyes Violet, Elizabeth Taylor. And she said, I write songs really spontaneously. I actually think it is kind of an interesting story of, like, how a song can come to exist.
From a conversation with
someone. From a conversation, even with Travis, who's just going, whoa, that's so cool.
Cool, bro.
Whoa.
Cool story, bro.
I didn't know all that. And you talk to me about this Emma Taylor girl again. So you told me.
And she had purple eyes?
You're really? Like, they weren't contacts? Anyway, much love to Travis.
Fat ass and baby face.
Much love to Travis, but it's not fascinating or anything, but it's like, oh, a song can come from anything and anywhere.
It can.
Even a song like Elizabeth Taylor, which is one of the most, I think, melodically Max Martin songs on the album. And I think it's really smart that she said, actually, that was my melody. Thank you.
Mine.
So there you have it. She also says this. Oh, my God, I forgot about this. Writing sessions is the way that I love to write because you're all in the room, everyone's bringing ideas, everyone's chiming in. I don't always apply the rule, I always apply the rule, may the best idea win. I don't care if it came from you or me. If it's better, that's what goes in the song. And I do kind of like it when people challenge me on something because I never want to be in the room with creators who are afraid that if they have a better idea, they can't argue with me because it must be my idea that makes it through. I'm never going to grow that way.
Okay.
Well, Aaron Dessner really needs to take notes. Because I Come Back Stronger Than a 90s Trend, he should have fought. He should have said, we're not doing that.
I think Jack does fight with her, but I think that Jack's inclination is to do more. And actually, Taylor has to rein him in. Remember when we heard his version of the Lakes production? Crazy. That was Cuckoo Banana Town. It was insane. I think it's part of, in my opinion, challenging yourself creatively is working with people you haven't worked with before.
There's something to that. To that I say, keep dreaming.
So whose best idea in the room was Good Thing I Like My Friends Canceled? Whose best idea was that?
We know whose best idea that was. We know exactly whose best idea that was. I don't think I brought this up on the podcast before, but I think there's something to this. Somebody said, I think Canceled exists, so when you search Taylor Swift Canceled, the song comes up and not what happened. And I was like, there's actually something to that.
The queen of SEO.
The queen of, like, redacting the document.
She said I wasn't.
I wasn't. I never was.
I stand with my canceled wife.
However, I
have never been canceled
myself.
I've
never been canceled myself because that would never happen to me.
No, I'm perfect. I'm the show girl.
But nonetheless, I definitely think Jack, he has such a strong personality. It's hard for me to imagine he would hear something and think it was shit and not be like,
I think we can do something better than that. Well, they also invented a whole new thing in her songwriting, which was the rant bridge.
They did. And, you know, again, I don't want to get too ahead because we'll talk about that when we talk about it. But correct me if I'm wrong. I never used this word or thought of this word to describe those bridges before.
No, me either.
Until Olivia Rodrigo said it. She was the first person that I ever, and I remember this because she said, oh, I like a ranting bridge. It's like a ranting bridge in Cruel Summer when she was talking about how she was inspired by Cruel Summer to do Deja Vu. And I was like, I wouldn't call it a rant. I remember that specifically.
You know what is a rant? Hits different is a rant. That's a Coke rant. That bridge is a Coke rant.
Well, I think once we ascribe a word like that to the thing, we start to lose the spontaneity of it. And it's like, okay, let's rant. And it's like,
no, it has to happen
really organically.
That's why Cruel Summer is the blueprint.
Right. Because she wasn't.
Death by a Thousand Cuts kind of has a rant bridge, too.
She wasn't ranting in the All Too Well bridge. She's not ranting in the Dear John bridge, which are also like some of her top bridges of all time.
No, they're carefully plotted through moments. That's not Hits like throw
the
caution
most,
to the wind.
Like ranty.
It's randomista time.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually.
Is Death there a rant bridge on cuts. Showgirl? No.
I think she'd say that about Eldest Daughter because of how it's structured.
I would call that whole song a rant.
Yeah, no, she doesn't really rant on Showgirl. I was trying to think of all the bridges.
She's ranting on Torture Poets. Title track, Torture Poets Bridge. That is a fucking rant.
Oh, for sure. That's a Coke rant if I've ever
heard it. The closest I've come to my heart exploding.
On Showgirl, the bridges are really short and simple. Like, even on Elizabeth Taylor, which is one of the best pop songs, the bridge is, all my white diamonds and lover.
And honey.
And honey. It's just a repurposing of the chorus or verse.
Anyway.
Okay, I think we have talked all that we want to talk about that. In Confessions.
Okay.
I'm kind of confused about why this is called Confessions.
Yeah.
But she says, well, I think that the 2010s was a time for women in the entertainment industry that we'll talk about later. We're all still limping away from that. I would really like you to explain more about
it. I'd like to talk about it now,
yeah,
especially
like
because
now.
You just go on to glaze a man for 10 minutes.
And I think that conversations are much more healthy now around. There's a difference between art and going and ranting on an Instagram Live. There's a difference. This
what
is
she
song.
Referencing there?
This takes craft. This takes, I don't know, Kim Kardashian?
Yeah, I can't think of anything else.
Like, I can't think of anybody that she's like had a beef with that is just logging
I guess back into. Back in the day, everybody was like, Kim Kardashian is so revolutionary. Like, she's really doing something different. And it's like, no, she's a relentless.
She could also just be
talentless.
Talking about like influencers and content creators in general.
Who she seems
she's
to hate.
She's getting us.
Who she seems to hate, by the way.
Yeah, she does.
Despite not being online to ever see them. Interesting.
And she's right anyway. Like, there is a huge difference between just getting on Instagram Live and screaming into the camera
100%.
And like writing a song.
Someone needs to tell Lana Del Rey that.
But I also am really excited. I'm a massive Somber fan of his songwriting, and his lyrics are so intensely confessional. I don't want another man's child to have the eyes of the girl I can't forget. Are you kidding me? Yes. Having a male artist say stuff like that is really good for the cause of women to be able to say stuff. It's ridiculous.
This,
but anyway.
No, this is crazy.
If there's any way we can make confessional songwriting a little bit more of something that isn't – people take that as sort of like you were being messy – you have to be fair to everyone then. Are rap beefs messy or are they confessional? I really don't think.
No, it's really hard to unpack everything that she's saying here because she's saying a lot of crazy stuff.
Let's make it a music conversation rather than just ganging up on the female artists. And I think the more male artists that are messy or emotionally complex or confessional or upset, the happier I am. So here's what her point. Here's what her point is supposed to be. She's saying, I'm tired of my music being treated like gossip. I'm tired of my music being treated like it's, you know, a couple of hens clucking because I'm a woman. And when I talk about confessional songwriting, it is me exposing my ex-boyfriends and I'm getting you and it's a parlor trick. But
and that's
men
totally
do
fair.
It,
that's a right. fair frustration. She's totally right to think that.
And when men do it, people take it more seriously. But I don't understand the when men do it, it makes it okay for women to do it because that hasn't been historically true ever.
For any cause that helps
for women. For
women
in the workplace, for women being able to vote.
No.
You think that the suffragists were saying more men should vote so that women can vote. I mean, it's just the logic isn't following. I understand what she's trying to say. I think she said it poorly. Also, bringing up rap beefs, the first one that's going to come to your mind in 2026 is Kendrick and Drake. And it's like, you're really going to say Not Like Us was confessional?
You're going to say that wasn't treated like drama. That was like the gossip of the year.
And I wouldn't.
And also, this is where she falls at her own fucking hurdle. It's like, you have a good hill, but you pick the wrong side of it to die on. Don't bring up rap music is so completely, it has a completely different set of cultural norms than the kind of songwriting and industry part that Taylor Swift lives in. It makes her look really out of touch with the understanding of what that is to correlate them in this way. That's not a good one for one comparison to make.
No, and it's now a couple of times where she's referenced it in a moment where it's not really referenceable. Like, for example, if I was out rapping about bitches, I don't remember the words.
Well, and also the thing about rap is that it is often perceived by racist people as not an art form. It is often overlooked as being a really serious form of lyricism. So for Taylor...
It's just she's not. She's bringing up something that isn't the logic's not following. Bring up Ed Sheeran.
Yeah.
And she won't.
She's done that before, though, and so, that made sense when she made that comparison.
This was just a very strange part of the interview. It kind of just felt like, I want to say that I like my new friend Somber. And it's like, okay, he's
You want to talk
nice
about how you want space for more female singer-songwriters to be able to do what you do, and the best way you can think to explain that is by glazing Somber and saying that if more men do it, then some girls, who are they? We don't know. I'm not going to tell you who. So they can, you know, inevitably become bigger and richer and famouser.
And there's, like, so many names that we know that she could have said.
Gracie Abrams, Sabrina Carpenter, all of her acolytes. There are so many people that she allegedly loves. I would like to hear about them. I don't want to hear about Somber. And this line that she brings up that is so amazing by him, I'm like, girl, get up.
The somber thing is getting a little strange. I don't mind that she likes him and, like, thinks that he's good. I have no issue with that. I have no problem with him whatsoever.
I don't think he's bad.
But I think it's really strange that you are mentioning one name in this whole interview.
First of all, that it's a man at all.
That's a man at all. And second of all, that it's that it's Somber. I guess he's hip. I don't know.
I would love to hear Taylor talking about someone like Audrey Hobart. There's so much Taylor in there. And there's so much, like, there's so many other artists that are trying to do confessional songwriting, that female artists that get caught in this trap. So why don't you talk about one of them that has been caught in the trap recently that you think is getting it a little bit too much?
And he also doesn't need the help. Like, he's had how many really, really high, like, Billboard charting hits? And he was performed Coachella, and people really liked it. His, in terms of men who performed at Coachella, if they're comparing Justin Bieber to another man, it's going to be Somber, and, like, comparing their performances, because Somber's was so great and Justin was doing YouTube.
Somber's had a pretty easy time of it. So it's just, again, Taylor, it's like, I'm going to do my whole album about how much feminism is important to me, and then I'm going to have all men on the stage with me for 1989.
It's a pattern of behavior.
Next.
But you didn't hear it from me.
Next.
So she says, narratives. I can only speak to me, but as I've grown up, the intensity of the sort of, no pun intended, message in a bottle nature of my songwriting has shifted and changed into something else. It used to be like, I can tell a person how I feel, so I'll write that in, or I'll write it in this song. And that was really important for me at the time that it was important for me. It's also important when you're in your early 20s and there's someone you shouldn't talk to and you don't want to call them because they're bad for you and it's toxic. So you just write it in the song and that's where it lives, almost as a method of self-control or self-preservation. But for the Folklore album and everything like that, it wasn't as a response to having a public life and the intrusions that came with that. It was really more just wanting to challenge myself as a writer. I really have always thought it would be so amazing to write books, and it's so exciting to have the challenge. Could I get enough plot points in a 3.5-minute song to where people felt like they read something after they heard it? Or just take you back to that bedtime story? Tell me a story. I want to be able to put my own image on these characters, like in Toy Story. And it was really amazing when it opened up my world. I don't think my songwriting has ever been the same after Folklore. I've always had a little bit of that character play in my songwriting since, and I hope it never goes anywhere because it's really fun.
I agree.
I love it. No, I absolutely love it. I love the fact that, because if we're talking Old Testament Taylor, when you were going to press play, there were a few early songs that were kind of like storytelling, like Mary Song, again, to come back to that one. But there wasn't a lot. Like, you knew when you were pressing play on Speak Now, you were getting like information about her life. That's what you knew. And it's fun now at this point in Taylor to like press play on a song and be like, okay, is this going to be about her? Is this going to be about her relationship? Is this going to be about a feeling? Is this going to be about an experience? Or is this going to be about something that, a movie that she was inspired by, or a book that she read, or something that she saw that inspired her to write a song, or a completely made up situation. And I find it really fun to kind of like go through and experience stories however she wants to tell them, whether they're real or not, is sort of secondary to just the songwriting itself.
I agree. Period.
And that's all there is to it. I think that the character songwriting is present on Showgirl. I think Elizabeth Taylor is probably the best example of it. And Father Figure, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's still that. Those are the two best examples on Showgirl.
And Life of a Showgirl. Life of a Showgirl is a very tortured poet song to me.
Kitty.
That's a very anthology song.
Her name was fucking Katie.
I see a link between the Bolter and Life of a Showgirl.
She made her money being pretty and fucking witty.
She did.
And have you? I'm asking.
And what's your tea?
What's your tea? I always love to bring up that my sister's name is Kitty. She doesn't... I wouldn't say that she's like the character in the song, though, so that's kind of funny, but...
She might be.
Her name is Kitty.
And she does have the life of a showgirl.
And she does kind of make her money being pretty and witty. Mm-hmm. So there's something to that. So the last section, or excuse me, not the last section, the second to last section is called Surviving the Industry. I kind of like being a narrator that's not the person I relate to. So the narrator in Clara Bow is either a Hollywood studio person or a label executive who's sitting, in my mind, behind a desk and meeting with a brand new starlet who has just come to town. The exec says, "You look like Clara Bow in this light. It's remarkable. You're so special. You're amazing." So it's funny that she says that, because I think parts of the song are from the executive's point of view, but it's like, I don't think the executive is saying, "Beauty is a beast that rots."
No, that's her social commentary.
That's her social commentary. So there's like a character, the narrator...
The narrator is observing the characters in the story
right.
and zooming out and having more to say about it.
Right.
Then she's like, this is about Stevie Nicks. It's about Stevie Nicks. I was like, just say Olivia Rodrigo. When she started explaining afterwards, like with the edge, I was like, oh, just say it. Why not just say it at this point?
Period. This is a good part. I like when she says, the entertainment industry love bombs women. We love you. We don't know who you are. Why are you even here? And so in the last verse, in my mind, it's a new artist, et cetera, et cetera. That is exactly what people, and they just did it with Chapel Roan. The most, and they're doing it now, I kind of think, with Olivia. I think Olivia, like the young, pretty thing, like that thing is fading away for her, and now people are starting to...
They're seeing their opportunity.
They're seeing their opportunity.
She's had her two good eras, now it's time to come and get her. Not me. Not on my watch.
Not me. And not me for Chapel either.
Mm-mm.
Every time I see it, like if it's really, really, obviously everybody's allowed to be like, I don't like that person and like move on with your day. But when I see it's becoming like a thing
that's when we mount our steeds and we ride for our canceled wives.
Because it's just like you can't, it's always something sinister and there's always like some cabal that's like, I don't know what is being gained from the Chapel Roan thing, but like somebody is getting something out of it.
Yeah, who's invested in this? I like a lot of the times
homophobes.
I'm like...
I mean, the list goes on and on, but it's scary. It's the cabal. Mm-hmm. That's all we have to know. It's the cabal.
We don't want you here. Cabal, get out of here. Scram, cabal.
So then she gets all into Nothing New and like relating it kind of to Clara Bow, which I think is very interesting.
Geniosity.
Geniosity. Did we do Nothing New, Clara Bow?
I think we did.
Well, of course we did.
Of course we did. Come on now. This is the Taylor Swift podcast.
On Rather was a song that I wrote alone in a hotel room when I was 22 called Nothing New. It sounds ridiculous, but at 22 years old, I felt completely washed up, which is crazy.
That is crazy.
I felt like maybe the only thing that made me special was that I was this teen phenom, whatever I was looked at as. So I wrote this song and it includes lines like, how can a person know everything at 18 and nothing at 22? Because when I was 18, I had the Fearless album come out and I had my first international number ones and everybody was like, oh, this writing, it's so true. It's so honest. We feel she deserves to be here. And then there was this big upheaval of, no, she doesn't. She sucks, actually. It really turned the tables on my perception of love can be so quickly handed to you and then taken away. It's a strange thing with fame, and that was the first time I ever grappled with that. And I think it's interesting because that period where she was realizing that they were putting her away, like that she was a toy they didn't want to play with anymore, is the exact time period where between Red and 1989 where she said, actually, I'm a feminist now.
And I'm a pop star.
And I'm a pop star, and I'm a feminist, and actually this is all wrong, and... I think there was a period of time where she really like basked in like, I'm young and I'm going to be 18 forever. And then it's like,
that's how it is when you're 18. Yep. You do feel like you're going to be 18 forever.
And then when it happens, especially like for women, it's like, hag at 22.
Yeah. You're like, what? I'm over. I just started.
It's crazy. Yeah. They're trying to be over you so fast. They're trying to be over Chapel. She doesn't even have two albums out.
But this thing for Taylor has happened so many times.
It's like constant because she doesn't go away. That's what it is.
They want to see you rise. They don't want you to reign.
They don't want you
to
reign.
They keep trying and you're never going to win.
And she does reign and that's the scary part.
Not for me.
So the last part of the interview is called We Want Your Art. Songwriting is something that is a very intimate, tiny little thing for me. I have a lot of things I like to do. I like to bake, I like to make art, I like to paint, I like to sew, I like to write songs. And I try to keep it as dear to me as those other things I just named. I have to know that there are certain things that we have as a tradition between me and my fans. They love for an emotional song to be track 5. There are special things like that. But at the same time, there's so many of them now, which is great. But there's corners of my fan base who are going to take things to a really extreme place. There's nothing I can do about that. There's people who are going to try to do detective work, figure out the details. Who is that about? What is this? When it gets a little bit weird for me is when people act like it's a paternity test. This song's about that person. Because I'm like, well, that dude didn't write the song. I did. But that's part of it. You have to hold tight to your perception of your art and your relationship with it. And then you just have to, like, there it goes. Hope you like it. If you don't now, hope you do in 5 years. And if you never do, I was doing it for me anyway.
Lots of things going on there. I think the first, well, that's what a lot of people said they were responding to. She was responding to us and the stuff that we do.
Well,
you need to
the
understand
thing.
Paternity
Everybody
test.
Everybody does it. This is the crazy thing. You do it. Let me Twitter search you right now. Have you ever mentioned Maddie? Have you ever mentioned Joe? Have you ever mentioned Travis? Your PFP is probably a picture of Travis right now.
Let's search the alchemy and see what you said
You're
about that.
You're doing it. And, like, what's crazy, really, and, like, this is the quiet part that nobody will say, she encouraged it.
Oh, she definitely.
If you joined 2021, you don't know. She did this, dude.
But also, if she really didn't want people to paternity test stuff, she wouldn't have done all of the Midnights and Torture Poets and Evermore Easter egging that she did on Torture Poets.
And the other thing
she,
is, like,
she connects the dots for you.
I don't even think she's talking about, like, oh,
people guessing,
figuring out what the song is.
Yeah.
I don't think that bothers her because she knows that, A, and she has encouraged it, B.
Well,
I think what she's saying is paternity testing, meaning the song is all about him.
Or that Joe wrote it for her.
Exactly.
I actually think that's what she's talking about, is all those fucking insane Joe widows that are obsessed with pretending that he had some sort of creative influence that is now gone from her career. That's what I really think she's referencing, and she's right, and she should say it. I also think she's talking to the Gaylors, too. She's being like, don't take shit out of context.
I think she's talking to anybody who takes it too far.
But she's also saying, I release myself from that. And that's the perfect attitude to have.
Well, you have to, because, like, you can't write Torture Poets if you're not released from it.
No.
Like, you can't. So it's like, there's a lot of people who do take it to an extreme place, but I find it interesting that it's like, oh, well, it's you guys because you said XYZ. And it's like, okay, but who's in my comments going sicko mode because I don't think the alchemy is about Travis Kelce? That's the crazy shit. I don't care. Like, truly, I don't care if you think it's about Travis. It's more fun that way anyway.
Yeah.
You're coming at me, and then on the same breath, you're going to turn around and be like, well, you're the psycho.
Everybody's so punk on the internet.
Everybody's really punk on the internet.
Overall, I think this was a great interview.
Overall, I think it was a great interview. Overall, I really enjoyed a lot of it. She gathered people who needed to be gathered. She
made a fool
deluded
of
herself
a little
multiple
bit.
Times. It's like a classic Taylor interview. It
no, that's
has everything.
Par for the course.
It has the delusions. It has the gathering. It has
the gag.
The gag.
The stories we already know that you're telling like we don't know them.
Right. The revelations. The stories we already knew. The stories we never heard before. The specific way that she describes things.
The Toy Story Easter egg.
The Toy Story Easter egging, which I'm gobbling up like a pig at the trough. Mm-hmm. And you already know that.
Yeah, we're ready for it.
I'm ready for Toy Story.
Well,
I'm ready.
Thank you for tuning in to Evolution of a Snake. Come and see us on tour or you're dead. evolutionofasnake.com. Thanks!